Talk given Sunday, December 19th, 1971. It is one of the significant features in the legendary accounts of the lives of the great teachers that at their birth the whole earth rejoices. You'll find this in the Bhagavata Purana in connection with Sri Krishna. You'll find this in the Zarathustrian Avastha. You will find this in the life of the Buddha. You will find this expressed in its own way in the life of Jesus Christ. You will also find that previous to the birth, the earth groans with sorrow because of the oppression upon her by men living evil lives. And when the teacher is born, the earth is gladdened. If we translate this into our own actual living experience, the earth symbolizes our own body, our own psychophysical organism. This psychophysical organism is caught up in what we commonly see and rightly call the becoming process, samsara, of the universe, and also, therefore, of the individual. Caught up in this, the whole psychophysical organism is in misery. The body undergoes pain, the soul is confused, is ill and suffers. But when the teacher, the enlightened one, the Christ, the Redeemer, or whoever it is born within our own inner consciousness, the whole psychophysical organism is gladdened. Now this is extremely significant, that the legendary accounts do present in beautiful and perfect form the story of our own lives. For never forget that the heart of religion is concerned essentially with you, the person, with me, the person. The heart of religion is concerned with the transformation of my mode of awareness of existence from a confused, conflicting mode, from the mode which is born of ignorance and passion and so forth, into the mode which is clear-sighted, which is utterly at peace, and through which all the great spiritual values like love, wisdom, truth, goodness, beauty, have what you will, are all freely and naturally expressed. Then those values, as transcendent values, find complete expression, quite beyond any conflict of the ordinary duals in our ambivalent state. Now, the important point is that we, as we are caught up in this becoming process. We are caught up in the becoming process simply because there is the fact of evolution. The organism is derived from the animal originally. And therefore the law of the animal, the law of the jungle, holds sway in the organism as such. And it must of necessity hold sway, because the law for the animal is the preservation of itself and the perpetuation of its species. Now, these two forces produce isolative self-consciousness in us human beings. And as a result of this isolative self-consciousness, our awareness of existence is one fundamentally of an unending conflict. As science at the end of the last century, for instance, put it, the universe is a hostile universe, which, of course, from the point of view of wholeness, is a false statement. But it was impossible for science to say anything different, because science approaches reality through the medium of matter, through the study of matter as expressing reality. So naturally, science had no option in those days but to say that. And if we approach reality and the understanding of the truth from the standpoint of the soul, as we call it, the psyche, there too our investigation stops short at the investigation of the ambivalent forces within the mind. Transcending this ambivalence means that we have entered the sphere which is the very heart of all religion. This which utterly transforms all that we ordinarily experience here with the consciousness that we do have. And the consciousness we do have, this discriminative consciousness, is the consciousness that is concerned with the duals, with the opposites, that is concerned, which is tied up, imprisoned, with this need for self-preservation and the preservation of the species. So now, this becoming process is our great prison house, so to say. And it is not that we have to get away from the becoming process, to escape it, or to fight against it. Woe betide the man who fights against it. He will be everlastingly in conflict. Our task is essentially to put it in a form which we have not considered previously. Our task essentially is to learn in this becoming process how to be what? To be not isolatively self-conscious, but to be aware in terms of wholeness, of complete relationship with all that has ordinarily been called by us the not-self. When we are in complete relationship with what we have ordinarily called the not-self, this unhappy barrier, screen, between self and not-self vanishes. There is then, in our own awareness, the one total reality. And when we live quite naturally animated by that overwhelming awareness of the one total reality, when we live that way, then at last we experience actually experience this extraordinary mystery, this mystery of being floating along on the tide of becoming. Being is in eternity. Becoming is in time. The life of the psychophysical organism is circumscribed completely by both space and time. And within that circumscription, there is no tangible or visible expression of eternity. But when in awareness one is wholly related with everything around one, one is no longer merely a separate part and parcel of the totality, but completely integrated, organically integrated into the whole. And then that separate selfness of one's psychophysical being vanishes as an obstructive factor. When that happens, then we can say that we are. Each one can say of himself, I am. You will find in the Upanishad, for instance, the Brihadaranyaka, in the first chapter, that extraordinary statement, in the beginning, this world, and please remember, world does not mean the planet and the galaxies and all the rest of it. It means your own living being, your own living body. This world was Atma only. And Atma is this state in which, through you, that transcendent awareness of totality works unhindered. That is the meaning of Atma. It is not a power, a divinity, a god, or anything like that. It is the story of you yourself looking around and seeing no other than himself. He said, I am. If you and I look around, we see innumerable others. Why do we see innumerable others? Now note carefully, of course there are innumerable others. An infinite multitude of others in terms of living beings and objects. But the important point is that I am conscious only in terms of the otherness. And I am blind to the reality of complete and total relationship with all that I call others. But when one is the Atma itself, the ultimate reality itself, then whatsoever one sees, that other is not I. Therefore, he says, I am. This I am lies also absolutely at the root of the whole of the Judeo-Christian tradition. Before Abraham was I am. It is usually written, before Abraham was, I am, which obviously is peculiarly ungrammatical. You solve that grammatic riddle if you realize that what Jesus actually said was, before Abraham was, I am. This I am, Ehyeh, in Hebrew, is the God name, so to say, of the ultimate, the supreme reality. Just how different is this Ehye from the Upanishadic Ahang, I am? Not at all. No difference whatsoever. The root of the two great traditions of the whole of the civilized world is just one eternal spiritual root, the ultimate truth, I am. So you see, in the realization of complete relationship, then at last there is true being. And whilst the psychophysical organism of necessity remains a separate organism, of necessity is mortal, the totality is expressed through that apparently separate organism. This is the meaning of fulfillment. And this being, whose context is eternity, moves, floating along, resting on the waters of the stream of becoming. Please don't get caught up with an idea or with an uplifting emotion. We have to realize it as a simple fact. But it is perhaps the last and the supreme fact that you and I can realize in our human existence. In the Psalms, "Be still and know that I am God." The same sort of teaching. And you find it universally given out, whether the religion be theistic, specifically theistic, or non-theistic. Never mind what the theologians say. They have to earn their living. And in order to earn their living, they have to be a little bit careful not to offend the ignorant multitude. So you will find specious arguments presented as regards the perpetual difference between the Creator and the created, between the Lord of creation and the creature. So, however, we won't go into that now. Let us consider very carefully this stream of becoming. When we are confined to the stream of becoming, what are the forces at work in our being, in our own personal psychophysical life? First and foremost, a state of ignorance, is it not? And how, if we recognize that fact, that it is a state of ignorance, how do we set about, that is, if we care for it, how do we set about becoming free of ignorance? We immediately attempt to find the truth, to seek the truth. But this surely is mistake number one. How can you find that which is omnipresent, that which is eternally there, that which never was born, nor changes, nor dies, which is immutable, which is totally beyond the senses, which cannot be seen, or touched, or tasted, or felt, or imagined, or thought of, or conceived by the mind. We are contained, wholly contained, within that truth. We, as we exist, are the marks, the signs, the symbols, the living representatives of that truth. But whilst we are unawake to the fact of the truth, the sign, the symbol, is rather sullied, rather muddied, and it is a sign which points not quite in the right direction. This is the fact of the matter. That truth we cannot find. Truth in this transcendent religious context is something which cannot be found, which cannot be sought. I have said over and over again, we don't go out to seek space. And if we did, we can't find space. Can't grasp it, smell it, touch it. You can't stake a claim to a certain volume of space anywhere in the universe. We just are in space, and space is in and through us absolutely, all the time. Even modern science knows that completely and thoroughly. So too, this transcendent reality, this transcendent truth, and I say transcendent truth and reality simply to suggest that it is something which essentially concerns our awareness, our mode of awareness of existence. Otherwise we could just as well say space. But the word space is so associated with things material and our physical existence that it is wise under the circumstances not to use the word space, but to use the word transcendence or the supreme truth. So now, this supreme truth is everything. Is everywhere. We can't seek it. That is not the way to be rid of ignorance. The way to be free from the shackles of ignorance is to be intensely conscious of the fact of ignorance. That's all. Not to seek truth or knowledge or enlightenment as an opposite to ignorance. Because if we seek something which is an opposite to ignorance, we seek something which in itself holds the seeds of ignorance, just as ignorance in itself holds the seeds ambivalently of its opposite, knowledge. Ambivalently, you can acquire, you can attain, achieve, gain knowledge. But the gaining and achieving and collecting of knowledge is a mere burden. This is all part of the process of becoming, the stream of becoming. When one sees that, really sees that, and becomes free of this fevered search for truth, it's only a passion to grasp, to gain, then one awakens to the fact of truth, which in the form which is most useful for us is clear insight into our ignorance. all the time. And our task here, whilst we live in this becoming process, in the world of mortality, is a task of continually discarding the not truth. In the discarding of the not truth, one is no longer bound within the limitations of the not truth. And when that is the case, the truth in itself, unknowable by the mere brain of man, functions freely and unhindered through our own being. So now, this ignorance is the parent of grasping, of fear, of acquisitiveness. All these things are in our nature simply because in this blind state we want to protect ourselves and perpetuate ourselves as we are. But if I seek to perpetuate myself as I am seeking to perpetuate that which is imperfect, that which is ill, that which is a thorn in the side of totality. It is not a question of perpetuating myself as I am. It is a question of changing, but changing in the right way. That is to say, changing in the way which means growth, true growth. And true growth in this instance does not mean expansion in time and space, but it means denudation of the whole of the mind so that it becomes utterly transparent, empty, free. And then that truth, that energy, that transcendent energy which is pure mind, works in such a manner through oneself, the individual, that falsity no longer appears in the life of that person. These are not easy things to penetrate into. They are admittedly difficult. But you will appreciate the fact that everything which is worthwhile, everything which is truly perfect, is very difficult. Try and produce sculpture or painting or music like the great geniuses did and see how difficult it is to do it. It isn't easy. Try and plan out and carry out all the necessary things which have to be done beforehand in order to make a flight to the moon and back in safety. Think of the enormous difficulty involved in it, the absolute perfection which is demanded. And do we think, therefore, that we can enter a jet plane, if not a chariot of fire with some horses, and just fly, get off to heaven like that? Not a bit of it. It is not quite so easy. So the change is the change in terms of growth. Growth which is a denudation, not an acquisition. This is the marvel of it. What happens? It is not you or I who grows. It is the totality which comes to flower in you. One has to say this over and over again because we are so egocentered, so self-oriented, instinctively, that we turn everything upside down. We crave for the wine of life, of eternal life. Perhaps it's poured into our cup. And what we do immediately is to turn that cup upside down instead of taking it to our lips. We exploit the truth, or try to exploit the truth. We try to cheat ourselves, thinking that we are really doing the right thing for ourselves. We are serving ourselves wrongly. That's why these things happen. And so, all along the line, in this becoming process, we fail to be. To be the reality. We are reality obstructed, reality sullied. Our task is to clean this temple, this house. Now that cleansing involves both intelligence and devotion. Absolutely steadfast, unwavering, night and day. It's not a thing for holy days or days set apart for God or truth or reality or whatever you like. It is a total business. Unobstructed in terms of parceling out times for the business. Because the life of holiness, the holy life, is living in eternity, not in time. But this eternity is manifested perpetually through every single instant of time. Because every single instant of time shows the shape of what oneself is. Because the senses function through time. And the consciousness of what is happening is in terms of the senses which function in time. And so every instant of time shows the shape of what we are. And if at any instant of time that shape is the unwhole state, the unholy state, then holiness has not flowered out fully. We see then that where our life in the becoming process is concerned, it is almost entirely self-oriented. Even when we live, as we commonly say, unselfishly, we are actually living selfishly, self-centeredly. We have identified ourselves with the family, with our society, with the cause, with all mankind, if you like. But we are taking sides with one. And if we are taking sides with one, we are in conflict with the other. The holy life isn't an easy one at all. It's extremely difficult. The way of holiness is very straight. And by no means straight. So now, because we are caught up in this animal type of awareness of our existence, and therefore are concerned with self-preservation and the preservation of the species, greed is a very powerful factor in our lives. The most powerful factor. We are constantly grasping at something. We have to, in order to perpetuate ourselves and to continue to exist. And if that greed is frustrated, there is resentment and hate. Watch very carefully. The cancerous intrusion of greed upon what we believe is pure love. Think of how love is possessive. Oh, I want to do everything for the sake of my loved one. And I immediately set about doing this, 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 and the other. But is all my planning and my doing related to the loved one, or is it entirely dominated by what I think is good for the loved one? That which I think is good for the loved one may be good, granted. But look how the lives of millions are strewn with wrecks all along the line in the name of love. And look at the feeling afterwards if one's efforts end up with no thanks, no acknowledgement, or with positive rebellion against parent or friend or teacher or whoever it may be. You did all this and kept me down. And the parent is absolutely flabbergasted. I did everything for you and this is your ingratitude to me. But you see, watch the factor of greed, possessiveness, domination coming in. Not that we are deliberately wicked. We do it out of ignorance. Look at all the do's and the don'ts, the club rules, the rules of our society and so forth, which we unquestioningly hand out and impose upon the new life, the young life. The rules may be good. They may bring quite good results in life, more or less, granted. But watch it carefully and see what has happened. We have distorted a life into our image of what that life should be. Without such distortion, that life may may flower out into something really wonderful. There we are. In what we call love, greed plays its part, and resentment at frustrated greed. So you see, the great spiritual values have no chance of coming out. The person has no chance to be. He's caught up in the coils of all that is associated with this becoming process. Oneself is caught up in those coils. Now, if oneself can see the way, can see light, and become purified within one's own being, then one's influence, inevitable influence upon his whole surrounding, will be a good influence, obviously. It will be a clean influence, a pure influence. Then there can be real love, there can be real wisdom, there can be holiness. But this is the thing that we shirk all along the line. We so love our egos. I am right. Of course I'm right. Always right. 20 years later, when I look back and say, oh, I was wrong then, it somehow doesn't come home to me that I was wrong. Quite casually I admit, oh yes, I made a little mistake there, but that's all right. Why is it all right in my case? It's not all right where the other person is concerned. So, you see, the implication of that. We cannot be truthful with ourselves. And if we cannot be truly loving, if we cannot be truthful, can we be good? Can we be happy? Healthy? Mentally healthy? Because mental health is identical with happiness. And if we are not all these things, then where are we? Are we human or are we subhuman? This is something I must recognize for myself. That I, as I am in fact subhuman, not truly human. For the truly human one, the full-fledged Son of Man, the full-fledged Son of pure mind, that is its literal meaning, pure mind, which is this transcendent creative power, which is itself virtue, the source of the moral imperative in me, the virtue which is spiritual health and wholeness, the virtue which is holiness, the virtue which is beauty that crowns the Lord in majesty and shapes the loveliness of all the world. That virtue is there when one is truly the Son of Man, the Son of Mind. And that Son of Man is also, therefore, the Son of God, the transcendent, the unknown, the unknowable, the unseizable, the ungraspable, but which you yourself can be simply because you have not tried to become God. The finite cannot become the infinite. But the finite can let go all its barriers, cast away all its veils, and standing in its utter naked purity, be at one with that infinite transcendent. This is the meaning of the birth of Christ, the Son of Man, who was also the Son of God. And how did men deal with him? When he said yea to that question, art thou the Son of the Blessed? And he said, I am. Ehiye. When the Son of Man, who is the Son of Mind, who is the original sinless Adam, created by the Eternal in his own image, dared to acknowledge the identity of that heavenly man himself with the Lord of heaven himself, Ehye, the supreme I am, then the Jews couldn't stand it any longer. So they crucified him. You see, in that was represented the ultimate fulfillment of being. Because that which represented the becoming process, the man Jesus, in his life through time and space on this planet, was completely disrupted. But that which arose, resurrected, and ascended was that being which is the one and only I am, the one and only being, free of all the shackles of time and space, untouched by cause and effect, untouched by anything which is unholy. There perhaps lies the significance, the deep spiritual significance of the rising out of death and the ascending into ultimate reality itself. You will see, if you care to work it out, wonderful correspondences between this and other religious traditions, which have presented in their own way the same story, the story of the liberation, the fruition and fulfillment through you and me of the one total reality. You see, sense this. If the sense of transcendence emerges, something new has happened. All the imprisoning, dominating, sorrow-bringing limitations of the ordinary sense consciousnesses and the work of the discursive mind, all that will disappear. And when the sense of transcendence emerges, you yourself in your everyday life, in every action and feeling and thought, will be free of the domination of ambivalence in the psyche. The either-or state, the love-hate, kindness-cruelty opposites. And only that transcendent holiness, the total wholeness, will be there through you. And in that state, you are in the state of bliss. The bliss which is not known by the mind, by the brain, which is not experienced as any kind of sensation. Because the sensation apparatus belongs to the mortal body. There is no sensation apparatus where the freed consciousness is concerned. And the freed consciousness is what religion can bring about, and the religious life. That state of bliss, of course, is the pure happiness of the mind, the health of the mind. The happiness which has nothing to do with pleasure, which has nothing to do with the avoidance of pain, nothing to do with the seesaw of the psychical joy sorrow that we can't ordinarily experience. And in that meaning and sense of happiness, let me wish you all a supremely happy Christmas. For if you can really experience such a happy Christmas, and realize the unification of the Son of Man with the Son of God, then you will realize spiritual prosperity in the full sense with the new year.